This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Step inside and get the knowledge you need to understand the issues that matter from people who really know what they're talking about. In this room, we value experts. And you can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds if it works for you, and especially if it doesn't and you have an idea about how it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. Our question today: why are so many people sleeping rough on Britain's streets? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Can I recommend to you to accompany this one, the one on Universal Credit? It was the coldest night of the winter last night. To many Britons, seeing other people sleeping rough on the freezing streets feels like something to be ashamed of. This morning, new figures for rough sleepers in England showed a minuscule reduction, 74, on a number that has been growing steadily since 2010. In many places, the numbers are up. The total is calculated to be 4,677 as counted on a single night last autumn. Step inside the briefing room to find out who's out there, why they're there, and what can be done about it. First, let's get an impression of what's going on from Risha Lancaster, who co-founded Coffee for Craig, an organisation which supports rough sleepers in Manchester during the day. She also works in a night shelter. What would it have been like last night in Manchester if you were rough sleeping?
If you were rough sleeping last night in Manchester, I think it would have been horrendous. It was freezing, absolutely freezing. I don't think I can even comprehend what it would be like, to be honest.
Can you just tell me what the difference is between homelessness and rough sleeping? Because in my experience, people get them mixed up.
If you're classed as homeless, then basically you haven't got a home of your own. So there's many, many people out there who may, for whatever reason, haven't got anywhere to call their own. So they're sofa surfing. So they might be sleeping on a friend's sofa. They might be sleeping in from house to house with relatives. There's also homelessness where they haven't got a home of their own and they've, for whatever reason, been housed either in a hostel or a bed and breakfast or a hotel. Rough sleeping is actually when people have run out of options. So they might have run out of people's sofas. They might have no family. They might not have presented to the council as homeless. So they haven't been given any sort of priority need or anything like that. So they find themselves on the streets with nowhere actually to go. Some people might present to the council and for many different reasons might not be found to have a priority of need. So they'll end up on the streets as well.
Now, can you talk about the kind of people who come into your drop-in centre, which caters for rough sleepers?
To be honest, I can't say that there's any specific kind of person. They're just people who have found themselves in a crisis. We've had people who might have broken up with a relationship and have nowhere else to go and have just hit the streets that night or that day and happen to come across us or have been signposted to us. And we also have people who have found themselves in such a spiral of desperation and hopelessness that they've been out on the streets for anything from weeks to months to even years.
Are they all jobless?
No, we have people who might be coming in who were doing agency work, who were working on construction sites. We have had a couple recently who were working in a sports warehouse and holding down a full-time job and sleeping in the tent. I've had a gentleman who came in who was actually a maths tutor in between sort of jobs, and I managed to be able to find him a shelter, and he's now working in Dubai.
So are you really saying that there are people who hold down a job?
Yes.
Whilst being rough sleepers?
Yeah, many, many people.
I mean, if you're on the streets, you don't have access to washing facilities and so on. How do you go from the street, sleeping on the streets, to go to a job?
Many of the day centres, actually, you have access to showers. If people come into our drop-in, you have access to a shower. We provide people with the ability to have a hot shower. And many of the day centres and services and outreach people out there provide clothing for people.
What about people with drugs and mental health problems? Are they a significant proportion of the people you see?
There's definitely a significant portion of people with mental health difficulties and problems, yes, definitely. It's really difficult because once you hit the streets, you come down into this spiral of depression, anxiety. It can kick off mental health problems just by being on the streets. And then, of course, you have people who have mental health problems in the beginning, slip through the net. Lack of sleep can cause mental health problems. And when you're sleeping on the street, you can't get a full night's sleep. You sort of catnap here and there. Many people sleep during the day because it's safer to sleep during the day. So sleep deprivation causes so many problems that it's hard to tell whether the mental health is caused through the rough sleeping or the mental health made that person rough sleep in the first place. It's hard to tell.
Risha Lancaster in Manchester. Next, I wanted to look behind today's figures. The BBC social affairs correspondent Michael Buchanan has been reporting on the rough sleeping situation for many years. Michael Buchanan, what do today's figures tell us?
Well, the overall headline, I suppose, is that the numbers have fallen by about 2% between 2017 and this count in 2018. That overall headline hides some variations. The figures for rough sleepers are up in the big cities. In London, they're up by 13%, Manchester 31%, Birmingham 60%. So that headline decrease has been driven by a reduction in the number of rough sleepers in other parts of England. So, for instance, in Brighton, there have been large falls. The numbers have fallen by about 2/3 in a year, and also in places like Southend, Luton and Maidstone as well. So overall, a 2% decrease driven by what's happening in English towns. But the figure to remember as well is that one-year snapshot is that since 2010, the number of people rough sleeping has increased in England by 165%. These figures today are the first time since 2010 there has actually been a decrease. Since then, they have gone up year on year on year. But what you are seeing is a slight change in the composition of people who are rough sleepers. So, for instance, some of the granular data that you see coming out today is that the number of British nationals who are sleeping on England streets have fallen slightly. They're about 2/3 or so. And similarly, the number of European Union nationals who are sleeping on the streets, they've increased as well a little bit. The number of women tends to stay about the same, around 14-15%. The vast majority of them, of course, being men.
The way in which this is counted is that you go around and you ask somebody on a particular night whether they are rough sleepers?
The way that it's counted has always been hugely controversial because this figure that we're talking about today, it is a one-night snapshot. So it is a mixture of some councils go out and they count them and can I see them and can I talk to them, and that's one. Another's an estimate built on local intelligence and local data. These annual snapshots that we report, they've always been contentious, and a charity like Crisis, for instance, would say that the real number of people rough sleeping is about three times the official figure in any one year.
If these figures are difficult to obtain, what of statistically of value can they tell us about the reasons why people are rough sleeping?
There's been a combination of things that have taken place in recent years. You have got benefit sanctions. Benefit sanctions are much more used now than they used to be. They cut people's benefits, and that has forced some people to lose their homes. You have got benefit freezes, which means that the rents and private sector haven't kept pace with the actual market, so people have lost their houses. Breakdown of personal relationships has always been an issue. It remains an issue. Cuts to drug and alcohol services. So a number of people on the streets obviously have drug and alcohol issues, and I've met any number of them who have told me that they are waiting to go into rehab, and I've been given a date perhaps in 6 months in advance to get into that. There's a squeeze on those services. And the other thing is there's been an increasing threshold for mental health support. So what happens is that effectively, for a number of people, they have to be sicker to be seen by the NHS and by mental health support services. And so while they're trying to cope with a lower level mental health problems, they have ended up losing their tenancy and being out in the streets.
We had the figures today for England. What do we know about Wales and Scotland?
Well, the system in Wales and Scotland for counting them is slightly different. Each nation decides how it does it themselves. We'll get new figures for Wales next week, I think it is. The most comparable Welsh figures, which was a 2017 count, showed that on their one-night count, there were 188 rough sleepers in Wales, and that's a figure that was up by a third on 2016. As I say, the system in Scotland is different again, but essentially just over 2,600 people reported sleeping rough in Scotland in 2017-18, and that is a figure that's risen by about 10% in 2 years.
One thing that kind of goes through your mind, and maybe I'm just a particularly unpleasant person, when you see somebody homeless on the streets, I've had this feeling, is surely there's a hostel for them.
There often is, but there aren't enough. So if you look at what's happening in Greater Manchester at the moment, where the mayor, Andy Burnham, has made a real effort to try and give everybody in the city, his initiative is called A Bed Every Night. There are more rough sleepers in the Greater Manchester area than they have been able to open hostel spaces and shelters. And that includes, in some cases, they have used rooms in fire stations and stuff just to give people shelter. The second thing to note is, even if there is a hostel space, is that some of them are dry facilities. So if you've got an alcohol problem, you're not allowed in there. Others don't allow pets in. Lots of homeless people have dogs. Some people have been so ingrained to living on the streets that it's really, really difficult for them to live in a closed environment. And simply the fact of being on the streets makes it, for some people, harder to live in those environments. So I've met a couple of people, for instance, who have been given beds and have ended up sleeping on the floor because they can't cope with a soft mattress. So in short, there are a number of hostels, and certainly over the winter there are more hostel places that are open. But in the main, there aren't enough of them, and for some people, they don't think it's appropriate for them.
Michael Buchanan. We've been here before, of course. In the late 1980s and early 90s, there was a spike in numbers of people sleeping on the streets, especially in London. In 1999, Louise Casey was appointed as the government's homelessness czar. Her job was to devise and to implement policies to reduce rough sleeping. Louise Casey, what was the first government intervention you can remember to tackle rough sleeping?
Great question. I mean, the first time a rough sleepers initiative was actually pre-1997. It was in the John Major period, when actually a great group of lobbying and campaigning and service delivery organisations in London, of which I was part, but I was very much a junior level at it all, they put a very coherent case together to Sir George Young, who was then the housing minister, and Michael Spicer before him. And they did put money and resources into rough sleeping. What was interesting is they did kind of money into day centres, into night shelters and those sorts of things. So very much the immediate alleviation of the suffering caused by homelessness. But they did go first, and that was ahead of the 1997 Labour government that essentially inherited that work, and they did a whole big, big, big drive in that direction, of which I became part.
Was rough sleeping seen as being a big problem in the early 90s and the mid-90s, in the period just before you got involved?
People listening to this may remember that there were classic quotes of, you know, you come out of the opera and step over a homeless person. That caused outrage that Sir George Young had said that. And I think, to be fair to him, he was outraged, and that's what he was saying. But it became very much, look at these awful Tories in power that don't care about people on the street.
Now, there you are. You've been appointed Tsar. What was your strategy for trying to tackle rough sleeping, and how did it evolve?
Well, I think what we had, and I use we deliberately because, you know, it was a collaboration, that essentially what we had was this brilliant report that set out both the kind of causes and the effects of rough sleeping, published in 98 by the Social Exclusion Unit. And so by the time I became the Rough Sleepers Czar, we had a plan that we could put together. And essentially, the interesting thing, I think, which the government isn't getting right at the moment, is I think of it, David, like an overflowing bath. You've got to switch the taps off. That's the first thing you've got to do. You reach in, and when you reach into the bath, you'll create a bit more problems. It's not straightforward because some water will go over the edge, etc. You pull the plug out, and actually you've got to make sure that that water drains away properly and doesn't come back again.
So coming down to the nitty-gritty, what were the most effective tactics or changes or psychological changes that you implemented which altered what was happening?
Well, I think what's really interesting about that, and where I think successive attempts have failed subsequently, is Everybody decided this was going to happen. The Prime Minister decided this was going to happen. His cabinet decided it was going to happen. You know, I went to see Tessa Jowell, who at that point was a minister for children in then the Department of Health, and said to her, will you help stop these kids coming out of care and ending up on the streets? And she told me the story that she felt herself, where she had been in a care home in Camden when she was a councillor, and literally kids were being discharged with black bin liners full of their clothing. That stopped, and it stopped because it's obvious they're going to end up on the street. And so what happened was there was just this, we mean it, we're serious. And the charities knew that. This wasn't just a money game. This was a determination, a top-down determination to essentially eradicate rough sleeping.
And as far as you know, what, when you stopped the job, had you got the numbers down to?
I remember to this day, the last street count while I was still Tsar, the central London number was something like 300 and something or other, but the overall statistics were in the small hundreds. And to be fair, they stayed that way and started to go back up gently ahead of 2010. But, you know, God knows now, it's just galling and disgraceful, the level of people that are forced out to sleep on the nation's streets.
Louise Casey. So what's being done now to reduce rough sleeping? Is it enough? And if not, what else might be tried? Louise Casey and I are joined by John Sparks, the CEO of Crisis, the national charity for homeless people, and Nicholas Pleese, the director of the Centre for Housing Policy at York University. John Sparks, I looked at the map on the BBC website of where there's the biggest rough sleeper problem, and there seem to be huge variations.
There are variations. What we've seen today is the government announced 2% reduction in the number of people counted or estimated to be rough sleeping, and some reductions in some places, a 40% increase in the West Midlands.
40%, 40.
Yeah, 42% increase in the West Midlands, a 12% increase in London. So yes, variations.
And I was also kind of picking out things like really big rates in places like Corby or Hastings or somewhere like that. What explains those, do you think?
Well, I think the only explanations are the wider explanations, how you explain very particular differences between one town and another, less certain. Although what we have seen is that where the government has focused attention on areas under its rough sleeping initiative, we've seen a bigger decrease in those areas than in other areas.
Now, overall, no one can cast this as being some great success, and I don't think anybody's trying to. So why, since 2010, is our current approach to tackling rough sleeping not working in your view, John?
So the thing they have chosen to do about it is to focus on investment in outreach work, focus on mental health support for people who are rough sleeping. Those things work. What they're not focusing on is preventing people going onto the streets in the first place, working with people when they're coming out of prison, out of the care system, out of the mental health system, to stop them becoming homeless. And of course, what they're not focusing on is mainstream, sustained housing that enables those people not to become homeless again.
Louise Casey, what's your view of why current policies are not working?
I think that what you've got is structural reasons, i.e. not enough houses being built for social rent. You've got things like universal credit that I'm really worried about, because essentially I think by essentially handing over all of the benefits, including housing benefit, to the tenant, some of those tenants can't cope with that. They might drink it away, they might gamble it away, they might not be able to live on the money that they've got and therefore spend it not on their rent but on their food.
This is because universal credit has changed the time frame within which it's paid.
Two things, David. First of all, it's changed the time frame, so we push people into debt. So you become unemployed, you wait for a long time before any money kicks in. Secondly, when that money does kick in, it's all given to you, as opposed to your housing bit, which is given to the landlord. And I think once you have large numbers of people sleeping rough, it becomes acceptable. People think it's all that's on offer. They think it's all that they need, all that they can get by. You know, I met a kid on the streets of Victoria. He's Glaswegian. He has no hope of getting back to Glasgow, but he's being told by London, by Westminster, and indeed by a voluntary organisation here, you've got to go back to Glasgow. Well, he ain't going to go back to Glasgow, and he just needs a job. At the moment, he isn't on drugs. He was clearly clean, and yet he's stuck. Now, a month from now, David, he's going to be on drugs or possibly on alcohol.
Nicholas, please, are other countries finding better answers to this problem than we are currently?
Well, yes, they are. I mean, and the difference really centres on the use of more integrated strategic responses to homelessness, which ranges from having a strategy that integrates prevention that John was talking about, but also using more kind of innovative models. But it's really about having clear strategic targets at national level and providing the right range of integration in terms of mental health, working together with addiction services, working together with social landlords, having city-level strategies that are coordinated and work with everybody, and building housing is fundamental.
Well, let's talk about the ones that you think are the most effective.
Over recent years, I've become a kind of advocate of Finland. And what Finland's done is this combination of mainly three things. The first is having a really good range of preventative services and integrating that into wider strategy. The second thing is using approaches like the Housing First model, which is the Finns have put their own particular spin on that.
What is that, if you could just explain it to us?
Okay, so traditionally our response to homelessness and a lot of stuff what we still do in the UK and Europe is what's called a housing ready approach. So you take the person from the street into a usually congregate building with on-site staffing. They'll have their own room, they'll have their own key worker, and that service makes them, in inverted commas, housing ready. So the idea is it trains up the individual to become housing ready and to be able to cope. That has some successes, but with people with high and complex needs, it doesn't tend to work so well. And what Housing First does is, well, the clue's in the name, really. It puts somebody straight into ordinary housing and it uses mobile support workers who visit the person at home.
What really? You take somebody who's sleeping rough and you say, here's a house to go to, mm-hmm. here's a home to go to.
Exactly that, yeah. You have a coordinated approach in that the key worker with the Housing First service connects them up to other services that they need, as well as providing practical support. One of the key things is the separation of housing and support, so that your tenancy is your tenancy and is not conditional on you doing certain things or behaving in certain ways. And probably the most controversial element of it, certainly in the US, where it was first developed by my colleague Sam Tsimbaris, is the harm reduction element, which is there's not an expectation that you stop drinking and you stop using drugs. And that's been, even in Finland where it's become mainstream strategy, that's quite a hard sell.
Louise Casey, the obvious kind of question that goes through your mind when you hear about something like Housing First is, doesn't this create a perverse incentive to put yourself on the streets? Because you just put yourself on the streets and know that somebody's going to stick you in a house.
It can do. You've got to be careful about the messaging. You know, there isn't finite resources, and that my view was we did at one point say to people, if somebody literally is able-bodied and on the streets and you know full well they were housed somewhere the night before, they are not going to be the people that jump the queue and leave a very vulnerable person that we haven't been able to get off the streets for years in. And I think institutionalising that, David, and making that something that is bureaucratic is very, very hard. It involves a great deal of trust between the person in government and the people that are doing the street work, and they have to be able to say no.
Nicholas, please, is the best approach to this a national strategic top-down approach in which, if you like, the kind of the resources of the nation are kind of girded up, etc.? Or is it a more local or city-centric or town-centred approach?
This is where I sound academic because it's both at once. you need a governing framework. You need to have an overall strategy and you need the resources of the state to be available and focused on the problem. But the problem is not consistent between different areas. So what you need to do in London is going to be different from what you need to do in Manchester. So you have to...
What would be an example of why that would be?
Well, for example, in London, while there are issues about the East European, Southern European economic migrants being on the street, that's going to be more of an issue in London than some other places. And it's important to kind of contextualise rough sleeping within the kind of wider patterns of homelessness, because the rough sleeping population, as John said, is people who start off at the kind of lower end of homelessness. And there's North American research that shows this, that, you know, it's people who can't escape from homelessness quite often, and things like mental health problems and addiction arise afterwards. So you need a combination of the two.
Is there any effective approach that we could take which would significantly reduce rough sleeping that isn't actually also pretty costly?
Yeah, and there is. And some work we did with myself and an American colleague, Dennis Culhane, did with Crisis a couple of years ago, illustrates the point. The Americans have this kind of picture that they use, which is Million Dollar Murray, and it's referenced to an individual who eventually died on the street. And what they did with Murray is they looked at what his experience has been and what contact with services he'd had, which was mainly emergency medical services, addiction, getting arrested for low-level stuff. And they figured out that he'd cost the state $1 million and nothing had really been done about his homelessness. That kind of thing, the cost offsets from having an effective intervention. So you do need to spend money on something like Housing First, but you're also tackling issues like the person who's the rough sleeper who turns up an A&E 80 times a year, the person with high and complex needs who's a rough sleeper who gets arrested 30 times a year, yeah, or gets sectioned. And those three things that I've just listed are just about the most expensive things that can happen to you. If you're stopping that kind of thing from happening by having interventions like Housing First, you're certainly not spending any more money and you could end up spending less.
Louise Casey, you've been very close to government, and this is a very familiar argument whenever it comes to expenditure, which is if you were to invest this amount of money, then in that case, eventually or quite soon, what's your take on the cost question?
Well, in my own time when I was doing the Troubled Families work, we ourselves somewhat controversially looked at cost-benefit analysis and tried to stack up the argument that high-cost individuals, which would be homeless people, or high-cost families, which would potentially be what the Tories call troubled families. The problem is that it's extremely difficult to really, really prove. And even the work that Dennis Culhane, extraordinary American researcher, wouldn't necessarily get it over the line with Her Majesty's Treasury. And the other aspect is, of course, those benefits go to the budgets that aren't about housing and homelessness. So the answer to your question is, will this take money? Yes, David, it will definitely take money. It takes money out of the department that is responsible for it. And if the Prime Minister and her government or his government want to solve rough sleeping or indeed homelessness, it costs.
OK, so that leads me to my final question, really, which is, if you were, each of you, advising government, what would be the first, I don't know, three things that you would do tomorrow, the week after and so on to try and sort it out? John Sparks.
So the first thing, because you can do it more quickly than building houses, is tackle the welfare system. The fact that housing benefits don't cover the cost of housing, so local housing allowances have been frozen for the last 3 years. The second thing would be about house building. You know, we need to build 90,000 social homes a year in England just to catch up with the backlog and then start to tackle homelessness. So we have to, the sooner we start, the sooner we have the impact of that. And the third thing is making sure that those people who are either rough sleeping or homeless or at very close risk of becoming homeless, we follow the evidence of what works to get them off the street and do that sustainably.
Nicholas, please.
Well, the first one would be housing supply. And I'd look at new technologies around doing something about that, things like modular technology and things like that, so that we can think about deploying more housing more quickly. And I think that's a crucial
modular thing. Technology for quick build housing.
Yeah. The second thing would be the integrated strategy I mentioned before. So prevention, coordination between the housing services and other services. And the third thing would be models like Housing First that are user-led, that work with people rather than trying to do things to them.
Louise Casey.
I would start off with the Prime Minister has to make it their job to end, or as good as end, rough sleeping. I think it only works on this sort of level when the person at the top is in charge. My second thing would be a big push again on prevention. I think, you know, it can be as much as knowing which prison discharges on a Friday afternoon, so we know people get nothing over the weekend and end up homeless. If they discharge on a Monday morning, they, you know, slightly fighting chance that they won't end up on the streets. And my third thing is I absolutely would go for vulnerability. You know, we've got really sick, vulnerable people on the streets, and that is something we can do something about. We've done it before and we can do it again, but we need to crack on with it.
Louise Casey there with John Sparks and Nicholas Pleece. So to sum up, we have a problem, we're not that close to solving it, but what we know from the past is that if the Prime Minister makes it a priority and brings together different bits of government, it's something we can solve. My thanks to Risha Lancaster, Michael Buchanan, Louise Casey, John Sparks and Nicholas Pleece, and we'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Serena Tarling, Helen Grady and Kirstine Knight. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We built up quite a library.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.